thanks, guys, for the review. It's pretty cool to watch.
Oh, thank you for letting us watch and review it.
Glad you saw it, too. That was cool to see you see it and share it and stuff. That was awesome. I was curious, though. What was the first thing you thought of when your PR company says, hey, the movie boners want to interview you?
There's so many names that it didn't even faze me. I was like, okay.
That's good. I was like, I think about that sometimes. I'm like, we chose this name. We never have had to, like, interview people when we chose it, obviously. And then now we're starting to, like, talk to more established people. And we're like, is it not going to change it, obviously, because it's awesome. But
I mean, it's good branding. It doesn't come off as, like, as lewd.
Yeah. Right. I wonder if I'm, like, used to it, but it does kind of seem like that's the case. That's good. So, yeah, we can get right into it. We're very excited to be able to connect with you, writer, director, producer, Jonathan Salemi. We watched a couple months ago your most recent movie, The Last Deal, and enjoyed it thoroughly. And we're also very intrigued by kind of the backstory of you making it and it being at least proposed to us as the biggest guerrilla-style movie shot entirely without permits of the last 20 years. That's true, right?
I mean, that we know of, it seems pretty close. I mean, if it's not, like, if you were to do a scale, I'd say we're in the top 1% of that.
Yeah, I imagine that there's not that many, at least they don't use it as an advertising thing, because most people probably don't want to get in trouble or something for that.
Yeah, somebody said it was like one of the biggest guerrilla films of all time, so we just started riding with it.
Yeah, and lean into it.
Yeah, I've just been saying it's potentially one of the biggest.
Yeah, it looks like it. When we heard that, we were like, oh, it's probably pretty, like, independent and small and quick and all that stuff. And then we watched it and we're pretty amazed at how clean and professional and established. And also, it engaged us seeing that, like, locations you were at. And I was always like, how'd they get into this building? How did they get to the airport? How did they do all these cool things?
Flying the plane around, like, what was gorilla and what wasn't? This is crazy.
I know. Yeah, we stole the plane and went up and brought it back down.
Hell yeah.
So for people that don't know, how much work or added cost does permits take? Because you told us that you shot in like 65 different locations. And I imagine that if you had gotten permits for all the places you should, is that a big expense or what does that even look like?
You're first looking at manpower, because you need enough of producers to clear them all, or a location manager, and just a ton of locations. So there's that part. There's the expense, which isn't too heavy, but depending where you are, you may need police detail or fire detail, or you may not be able to shoot in that location at all. Like the river scene, where there was like that big, like, event at the middle of the film, there's no way we could have shot there. Like going through downtown LA with the camera rigged to the van on the side, you know, like somebody could hit their camera. Like all that stuff, but like we were very safe the whole time. So anytime we did do like the camera rigging or anything like that, we always had a follow and a lead car, which basically means there's a car in front and behind, and we're all on walkies, and we always have eyes all around, so no one's ever in any danger. Okay. But like to get the permits to do that can be a process. So I wish I could give a dollar figure for like, hey, I think it would cost this much extra, like maybe another 60,000, maybe.
Okay.
Maybe 100, I'm not sure.
Definitely significant, especially for smaller filmmakers who are trying to tell a story and put something cool out there. I feel like all the extra red tape definitely inhibits people being able to do that.
Yeah, the amount of time it would take to clear them all, to get it all taken care of. Whereas, oh no, let's just go there for 3 hours and leave.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it seems like there's not really anything that it hurts. Like as long as you're safe, or even just being conscientious of the people around you, not blocking traffic or whatever, then it doesn't matter that much. It seems like a way for people to like kind of capitalize on the film industry and Hollywood and being able to make some money off of them and like gatekeep maybe a little bit of, oh, you're allowed to use this cool place if you pay us money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we did pay a couple people to use their place, of course, you know, like the inside of a gym or something like that. But but yeah, you know, that was sort of the motto going into it, of or the way we would look at it before everyone came on. We were in casting. They all knew, like, hey, there'd be no permits. This is the way it would look. If that's not something you would want to be involved in, that's okay. But, you know, you'll be safe at all times. And so everyone kind of, I think, loved that part of it and enjoyed it. And it heightened the anxiety of us shooting. And when you got everyone to buy into that theme of how you're going to shoot, you know, then you're like, okay, this is just the way it's going to be.
I could see that translating when you're making a thriller. It makes it a little more exciting for the people making it too.
Yeah. Yeah. And we never like, of course we wanted a pretty high speed, like as far as like how fast we would shoot and stuff like that. But we always got plenty of coverage and plenty of takes. And there's only a couple times that it was like, really like you have to like rush to make sure you get it all because you're somewhere that you're not supposed to be, like the airport scene where Vince gives Tabitha to his friend Carter to be safe, and Carter takes her off. Like, we're directly feet from the tarmac there, the runway. And the airport police keep going by on the runway, checking up on us, having the flashlight. And we were in the middle of a road. It was a street. And the police would come by on the street and see us. And I just make sure I wave, and I'm like, hey, you know, this is what we're doing, blah, blah, if they ask. But they never asked there. And we just started getting more greedy. Dominic, the DP, started putting C-stands in the street. And we had C-stands going around the middle of the street. And the whole time I'm nervous. I'm like, well, you know, let's just make sure we get this all. Like, I think we're being a little greedy here. So let's just make sure we get all the coverage. So you do have, I have a certain, very heightened anxiety because I just don't want to be shut down. So, yeah, there was definitely an anxiety that I had every day doing.
Whose decision was it to forego permits? Was it in the beginning?
Yeah, it was mine. I knew all along that there would be no permits.
And did that tie into the story that you were telling? Because I see parallels there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things we got from it, which was like a happy accident, was the higher anxiety for a thriller. So everyone in the cast and crew has that anxiety because you're not shooting with permits. But for me, the reason why I wanted to do it, less so the permit matter, but all the locations, was I was like, hey, you know, if I'm going to make this indie near micro budget film, I don't want it to look like it's been all shot in an apartment and we're just seeing the same location all the time. Like, I want to make like a Christopher Nolan or Mission Impossible that you go to Paris and Rome and Australia, and that's always fun to watch in the theater. Mm-hmm. I said, well, I can't go to those locations, but I can go to the airport and the marijuana field and the bridge and downtown and go to all these places around SoCal. So I was trying to make like a really epic indie film.
Yeah.
I think it feels that way. You're in restaurants and lobbies and all those interesting places, but it thematically ties into the story with Vince not being able to get a permit or a license to deal once the marijuana industry goes legit or prohibition ends, which is interesting.
Yeah, there's that part too. Yeah, it works well. It looks nice. So now when you're watching it, you're like, hey, this isn't the film I expected it to be.
It really wasn't. Yeah.
Thanks.
Well, actually, you already answered like my main one, which was just kind of the initial like reaction from your cast and your crew of telling them, hey, here's the plan of forgoing all of those permits. You know, you already answered that, just kind of getting everyone on board. I think that's pretty cool. Yeah, I don't have too much really in terms of that. I knew the gorilla talk was going to be a lot right out the gate because that was something that
Jay. I've got a short follow up.
Yeah.
So the river location was one of the ones I really wanted. I knew it would cinematically look really good. And that's the one where the throat gets slit. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I lived not too far from the river, probably like maybe 15 minutes away. And it's during COVID. So I'm scouting in probably between March, or I am scouting between March and August of 2020. So there's no one around and everyone's working from home. I went to that river no less than probably 10 times. And because there was a lock, so that place where we're at is gated in. Uh-huh. And occasionally the gate's open. And so I went there every day just to make sure the gate stays open. Because if they close it, it's like the DPW, like the Department of Public Works thing. Okay. If they close it, then I'm screwed. So I had to always have a plan B. No matter where we were, there was always a plan B that, hey, if we can't get these shots, we'll go over here and get them. And so I had all these different parts of the river that I had as a plan B. And I also got bolt cutters. So I went to Home Depot. This is probably 3 days before the actual we had our first shooting day. And I was in Home Depot and I learned how to break locks through YouTube. And if you put two wrenches together and go like this, like you have them like butt up like this and then pull them apart, it'll break most master locks. So I bought two big wrenches. I had a bolt cutter. And I'm leaving Home Depot and I'm like, because the expenses are adding up. Like you're paying for all these things, even though you're making this no budget, no permit film. And I'm in the parking lot with these wrenches. And I only spent like $80 because I had to get zip ties and stuff like that too for the bodies that we were going to kill or whatever. And I'm in the parking lot. And I'm like, what the hell am I doing? Like
loading it all in your trunk. Yeah.
And I remember saying to myself, I forget if it's what movie it's from, but it's like, just because you can do something doesn't mean you should.
Yeah.
And so I said that in my head. I was like, oh my God. So like when we go to the location, or the day or two before, because that river scene was day three of the shoot. And I had Mike Ferguson, who's the tatted up guy, and Sala Baker, who plays the main bad guy. And we're shooting some scenes before that day. And I'm like, hey guys, you know, I'm a little afraid of the river. Like I'm starting to get scared if we can be down there. We're going to have too many people. And I want to make sure you guys feel good. Because the biggest thing is I want to make sure they're safe and they feel comfortable. Because if they don't feel comfortable, it's going to come out. And they're all like, yeah, no, fuck yeah, let's do it. I was like, you sure? And they're like, no, that's it. I was like, all right. And so yeah, we were down there with like 20 people, like on the river, slicing somebody's throat with a knife. It was, and fortunately the gate was open.
Yeah.
Didn't have to break it. That's awesome.
But yeah, that was like, I was so anxious going into that day and after it. And then that same day, so we got the shots, and that same day, the following day was going to be all Vince's apartment, and it was one of my friends, and his sister, it's COVID, like 12 hours before our shoot was like, hey, I don't want anyone coming down, so we had to like, I had to try to find a location. I felt like I got punched at like 9 p.m., and I think I had to cancel the next day or like find something else to shoot. It was just constant like I was taking L's and I was like, oh my God.
Yeah. Even what you think are the safest locations or the most sure locations don't always come through. Yeah.
But it worked out well. We got a different apartment that was actually better and had better views. So, you know, there's a lot of like good, happy accidents that happened.
That's awesome.
Yeah. That's good. Yeah. That's funny that you had to do like espionage to prep.
Yes. Yeah. it was funny that you referenced Mission Impossible early. Sounds like it.
Yeah.
So you said you started scouting during COVID. Was that kind of when you initially started writing this movie or just kind of prepping for the story?
So I actually started writing the movie in October of 2019.
Okay.
So I didn't have any idea what the movie was. I had, because I knew I wasn't getting opportunities to direct, and I knew I had to write my own script, and I wanted to make something very commercial that people would watch. So I knew no matter what, it would go on Amazon and all that stuff. So I had a certain formula in my head. Like, I want somebody with their back against the wall, and I have access to marijuana fields and planes, so how can I incorporate that? And then I watched John Cassavetes' movie in October 2019, Killing of a Chinese Bookie, where the main character has a gambling debt and he can't pay it back. So they tell him to kill this bookie and then his debt will be erased. But little does he know, after he kills the bookie, they're going to kill him. So I was like, oh, that's a great idea. That's my film. I can make that. And it was very like, I don't want to use that avant-garde, but it was very indie at the time. So like Cassavetes is improv-ing and they buzz focus and they're not really held to studio standards. So it has a nice like gritty feel. I was like, oh, I can make that. I just need a really good DP and a cast that's all aboard. I won't have any permits. So I knew that right away. And just have a ton of locations and shoot around LA, make it very like Michael Mann, Miami Vice. And so, yeah, I knew about marijuana and legalities there. I was like, okay, yeah, I'll just give him a debt. Like he, because it's based on a true story of my buddy, who actually had dinner with him and his wife last night, who was growing and had a dispensary. And then once cannabis became legal, like his sales just went straight down. Mm-hmm. So I was like, hey, I'll have that. The guy has no money. He's got his back against the wall. He needs to do one big score and then he's out. Mm-hmm. And then have everything that could go wrong go wrong. So I did the, I had a outline within a week. And then, and then I was bouncing that outline with my buddy Carl Stefario, who's a veteran stunt guy. You've seen him before. You probably know him best as the guy with his head in the vice in Casino.
Yes.
Yeah, so that's Carl. He's in tons of stuff. He gets shot up in RoboCop. But so I was giving him that, and it was a pretty cool little story. I had it. It was very like 40s noir, where the guy dies at the end and like he's shot in the belly, sort of typical Hollywood thing. And they had him in a plane as he was going to like Oregon to like go to the family farm before he dies. And so it was like, you know, it was very like Asphalt Jungle, 1940s noir, but with a very modern feel. And so it ended up developing a little bit more. Christmas break, I was like, okay, let's do it. And I wrote the script in like 30 days. Just got it out, like made it as bonkers as I wanted to make it. I had a train chase in it, like they were running through a train, because you could gorilla that too. I knew how I could do that over a few days, like just shoot pieces, and make it very like, not De Niro, who's the other guy, Pacino, Serpico.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Or Stallone Nighthawks, like very much like that. And I also had like a huge like machete scene at the end where he chops off the guy's hand. It was just bonkers. It was wild. There was a car chase, but I couldn't afford to do a good car chase, so I had them chasing a bicycle. So Vince jumps on a bicycle and they have a car chase, and you just shoot it with like longer lenses and all that stuff. But anyway, I had that, and then we just kept developing until we had the shoot. So if you look at the timeline, it was October 2019, had the idea, wrote it in 30 days over Christmas. And then I was on set from the idea in October within like 9 months.
Wow.
Dang.
Yeah.
That's pretty fast development for sure.
Pretty wild. Yeah.
You mentioned Miami Vice, and I definitely felt kind of Miami Vice vibes, or maybe even the closest we've gotten to like a Grand Theft Auto movie. Yeah. Especially with the intro and the voiceover and that synthesizer soundtrack. I love the soundtrack of this movie. Yeah. It felt very GTA kind of.
You can think we had, so one of my buddies, Scott, has his own synthwave show, and okay. He knows all the synthwave artists, like the big ones and stuff like that. So he got me all the music. And then Tony Fiala that did the score, just blended the score to be a little bit more Cynthia Neon. Mm-hmm. It was a nice little marriage.
That's very cool.
That's a fantastic score.
And yeah, it's pretty fun.
He's a big fan of that synth stuff, so
yeah.
It's fun. It's
the movie itself isn't like neon, but it still has that Outrun feel to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like the new King Kong. I'm not sure if you guys saw the new King Kong Godzilla film.
I did. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was synthwave in that. Like there's a lot of people
are more synthwave into that.
I like my my favorite, it's not a movie with a lot of jokes in it, but I really liked the quick conversation at the airport when Vince is getting the black duffel bag and the guy giving it to him is like, I want that back. Make sure because that back. I'm always handing out these disposable duffel bags and nobody gives them back and the costs just start adding up. Yeah. And it really made me think of like all the movies that I always see, whether it's money or drugs, people are giving these bags away and what that must mean for who's purchasing them or acquiring them. It was pretty so clever. True. I like that.
Yeah, that came about. My cousin made a short film called Brief and they had a drug deal. And the guy gave the guy a bag. He's like, oh, I want the bag back. like, that's a pretty funny joke. But and they based a short film around that.
I think that's awesome. So I was
like, we just use that as a line.
Yeah, I thought it added a lot to it. That was awesome. And then your IMDb page says that you used to convince your fifth grade teacher to let you write or make movies instead of turn in papers. And it reminded me of like, I always love those stories of writer directors that made movies from a very young age. Like they've always just loved making movies, whether it's M. Night Shyamalan or whoever, there's always those, like you've always been attracted to it. So I was curious what your formative influences were, whether it's filmmakers or just artists in general that led you to here making and producing and directing movies.
Yeah, it started, I think, when I was like 5. So my dad would have a Super 8 camera and then project the home movies on the living room wall. And I just remember as a kid just being mesmerized. I was like, oh my God, what is that? And I would always ask him to take out the projector and do it again and again and again. And then he got a like the Marty McFly VHS camera. And yeah. So I would start... I'd skip school in like eighth grade or, I guess I got to go back. It's like fourth or fifth that I started doing that stuff. But like I would just make stop motion G.I. Joe films. and then I enjoyed it. And I asked my teacher at the time, I think his name was Mr. Furman, I think. And I was like, hey, can I do this? And they were like, yeah, sure. So we just took like current events and made movies of it and used my sisters and used G.I. Joes. And, and then, yeah, I would occasionally sometimes like skip school and make movies and stuff like that. They were never as good as like Shyamalan's first films when he was a kid or Spielberg's Firefly. I don't know if you ever saw any pieces of that. Like it was never as advanced as that. It wasn't until like maybe like I was like around eighth grade or so that I started like putting planes on wires and have them go from like my bedroom window on the second floor down. Mm-hmm. But it never got any creative. Gripty. Like it was just like these made up things that I would have to edit in camera. So I would have to literally like be like action, then press record. You do your part, then I turn it off, and then you would chronologically have to shoot it. So this way I didn't have to edit it. Yeah.
Well, I don't know, man. Awesome. You said you started doing stop motion with G.I. Joes. That's pretty advanced for like fourth and fifth grade.
Yeah. Stop motions is so involved.
That's a lot of patience for a fourth or fifth grader. So
yeah.
Props, man.
Yeah.
Props.
The same cousin that had the short film, he's older than me and he was making his own films. Like his own little like Back to the Future kind of things, and that always appealed to me. So I had like the influences around me that like then I just gravitated towards it, and I just went to the movies a lot as a kid, like a lot.
So, yeah,
I'd sneak in and I'd stay there all day.
Nothing wrong with that, man.
Yeah, I think that's the best way to start. Is just as a fan of film yourself. Yeah, it's awesome.
So I know you've done a couple like feature length and some short films. And I was just kind of curious, like, which one do you find more rewarding as a filmmaker? Like, do you think the short films are something big names need to keep doing just to kind of keep the craft going, keep honing their techniques or coming up with new techniques, kind of
experimenting?
Yeah.
I mean, I think if you're ever drawn towards something creatively or out of curiosity, you should definitely explore that. So if there's like a short that you're looking to make on whatever topic or whatever idea you have, like definitely go off and see if you can make it. For me, it was probably the most creative I could be because I didn't have any, not people to report to, but like preconceived notions. So I could make these very experimental kind of films. And that was very educational for me because the first film I made was a feature. And then I followed that by three shorts. And those three shorts, like, inform me a lot of what my voice is. So, like, there was always, like, in those shorts, there was a very heavy Terrence Malick kind of influence. Okay. But as the shorts moved on or progressed, they got more commercial in sense. Like, hey, dealing with sci-fi elements or stunts and stuff like that. And so by the end, I knew what my voice was and what I wanted to tell. And also, it was very fulfilling making them, but then you want to reach a wider audience and you want to get your project out there and not be somebody who's like labeled as this is like a hobby, you know, because it's not.
Be taken seriously.
Yeah.
Correct. So like making the feature and then getting more opportunities, because you can pretty much plateau if you stay within shorts. But yeah, once you start doing the features, then a whole new door opens, and now it's just a matter of like, hey, what budget level do you want to stay at, or do you want to get higher, and just really exploring good themes and what's the word? It's like creatively challenging yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there isn't really a distribution avenue for short films other than like YouTube. It seems like. Like you're not going to find them on Netflix or Hulu.
Correct. Yeah, the last two shorts I did got on Shorts HD, which is a station that some people get with DirecTV. So they did get the distribution. One got on PBS, played at the Sydney Opera House, which was cool. So those are great, and they're good wins, and they're good ways to like go to a ton of festivals and really learn about that and see what other filmmakers are making. And that's a huge education in itself. And making friends and connections there.
Yeah. Get noticed and then build on that.
Yeah.
I did want to ask you about the cast and finding them, cause they're all great and fantastic. Yeah. And you mentioned Mike Ferguson and Sala Baker as kind of the two main bad guys, and they're very intimidating and scary in a way that you want them to be. But I really liked Anthony Molinari as Vincent, as your main protagonist. He was very relatable, and I just felt like as he gets down this path of everything falling apart and all the stakes get higher and higher and he has no way out, I don't know, I identified with him for sure. So how did you come to meet all of them?
Yeah, so very fortunate again, COVID, which horrible time, but fortunate in the sense that people were available to work because our industry was shut down. So Anthony had met through Carl Savaglio, who was the producer. He did stunts with Anthony, introduced me to him. Anthony emailed his audition in, and he was great. And I was like, oh, this is the person I want to work with. So, and by that, what I mean is he's worked with Eastwood and Johnny Depp and Tom Cruise and really big studio films. He's doing like he's Matt Damon stunt double, George Clooney stunt double.
Oh, damn.
So you're dealing with someone that's been on enormous Hollywood sets. And I was like, okay, this is the type of people that I want to work with. And I think it's a good leader for the cast as well. So very fortunate to get it. Anthony just did an amazing job. Then Anthony was friends with Sala and recommended Sala. Talked to Sala. Like, I was like, oh my God, this is like my Hans Gruber. Like, has an accent and all that stuff. Like I wasn't expecting to get a bad guy with an accent. And Sala was just awesome. And then the rest was through LA Casting. I think LA Casting and then Breakdown Services. So... Mister, who was just amazing at the time. When we saw him, we knew we needed to put him somewhere in the film because I think he auditioned for a couple different parts. He was in New York, so he flew out. Jeffrey did an amazing job. Just such like a spark plug with a like fiery personality that worked out great. And then we got Mike Ferguson, Connor Floyd, who played Marcus, who was buying weed off of Vince in the beginning, and like all those other parts, like were just a ton of like date players that somebody knew or we got off of casting. So it worked out well.
Yeah, definitely.
It's an awesome cast, and Sala he's very intimidating.
Yeah,
I've watched it a few times now, and every time I'm like, this dude's he's a great villain. He's a good, intimidating villain. So he might be my favorite character in the movie, honestly.
Yeah, he gets the camera well. He understands it and where to look and how to frame himself and like the movements and all that stuff. So yeah, and he's just very intimidating. He's one of the hits in that new Fincher film, The Killer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, plays the brute.
Yeah. So
yeah, and it's cool timing with your movie that he kind of, as he gets noticed in The Killer, you maybe get a little bump as well.
Oh yeah,
of course. That's awesome. And these are all stunt guys too, so I could keep all my stunts in camera, which is very important. Yeah.
It's cool to have stunts kind of be more stunt workers, professionals be more center focused and get a little highlighted. We always love that.
Yeah, we're big fans of the stunt guys out there. So it's awesome to hear you talk so much about having all of these stunt professionals around and being a part of and involved with all of it. That's just props to you on keeping that at the forefront. So.
Yeah, I was very fortunate to have them. And it's an untapped resource. You know, these are people that are no longer like before the 80s, like you would never see them. It would be like, all right, double. And then this person flies off or something like that. These people are performing or acting because movies are condensing as well as budgets. So they're keeping elements more on screen and not paying extra roles and stuff like, or for extra roles. So you're dealing with performers that work a lot and are incredibly experienced, like, and they're an untapped resource. Like James Logan, he's a stunt performer too. He plays the cannabis regulator that Vince talks to with downtown LA in the background. Yeah. And James did an amazing job. You know, he's been acting for a long, long time, as well as doing stunts for a long, long time. So yeah, if you ever have a film you want to make, like, definitely look at the stunt community, because you're going to get people that people recognize and performers that work a lot and I think deserve more recognition.
Yeah, and I imagine with their experience and being on sets and being involved with a bunch of different productions and directors and stuff, could also lend advice or influence or whatever to make this shot better, make this experience better.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's like a huge part of it. Like, you're collaborating with them and we're looking at it in the monitor, be like, hey, oh yeah, you know, let's fix this by here. Let's, you know, have them clock the guy over here a little bit more. I think we can speed this up. So yeah, it's a amazing opportunity, you know, like, that's look fantastic. At how many, no knock against anyone else, but look at a lot of the very indie action films that you watch and people aren't, like, punches aren't connecting and it doesn't look legit. Like, it was very important for me to have it look like legit.
So. Yeah. I would say there's not a ton of action in like the first half of the movie, but towards the end, the violence and stuff is very cool and very interesting in the last deal specifically. I think that's pretty much all we had. I definitely wanted to make sure that people know The Last Deal is out on digital for rent and purchase and on streaming on Stars, and then basically all of the major services that have Stars as an add-on. So Hulu, YouTube, Amazon Prime, all the big ones. Definitely, I think it's a recommend if you like 100%. Crime thrillers and action movies. It was a really fun time.
Thank you.
Is there anything you're working on now or anything you want to plug? Anything you want to have people made aware of?
We're packaging a new movie right now. We sent our first offer to an actress last week. The distributors of The Last Deal are in Cannes. So at the time of this recording, Cannes is going on. And it's a huge market for selling and packaging and all of that sort. So they're pitching my next film over there. Right now it's called Death Diner 76.
Okay.
That sounds cool.
All right.
And it's basically about a, I'm going to butcher this because I don't say the log line often, but it's basically about a ex-nurse that was accused of killing a bunch of Cub Scouts, and now she's out of prison and working the graveyard shift at a diner on parole. Meanwhile, the chef has a fascination with her and wants to go on a killing spree.
Oh,
cool. Interesting.
All right.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm into that.
Yeah, that sounds... That went right up my alley. Like, ooh, this sounds intense.
Yeah, so hopefully, knock on wood, we'll be shooting that this year. I hope so.
That's awesome.
Cool.
We'll look forward to
watching it. Yeah, that sounds amazing. All right. Well, thanks, man. Yeah. This has been awesome.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate you.
The opportunity. This was fantastic, and can't wait to see more from you.
Appreciate it. Yeah. No, thank you guys for liking the movie and being passionate about it. It's always great when it hits with somebody and you get it for what it was or what it is.
Right. Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, we appreciate it. And I'm sure we'll talk later.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, sir.
Yeah.